Well, thank you for coming along today, and I'd like to thank Lars for inviting me to visit here to discuss this. And he's asked me to give a kind of general overview of the phenomena in addition to the theoretical issues that we've been concerned with. So the first part of the talk will be an introduction to helium droplets and what one can do with them, which is really something that has blossomed in the last about 8 years, actually. But they are indeed quite old. And in fact, Kamerlingh Onnes, when he was first trying to liquefy helium, made some observations of a helium fog, which he thought would be droplets of helium. And this was, however, since he did this in April and he managed to liquefy helium in July, he then went on to bigger and better things, and helium droplets were really then left alone for about 60 years or so. The superfluidity of bulk helium was discovered in 1938, and when people started to work again on droplets, that was in the 1960s or so in Germany, the issue of superfluidity and whether you could have superfluidity in a finite free droplet of helium was a very big motivating factor then, and how the scaling would happen. So let me just, this is just a summary of some of the elementary facts about superfluidity, the phenomenology. First of all, the phase diagram that shows you the temperature range, where in the bulk you see the superfluid phenomena below 2 degrees Kelvin. The signature of the phase transition.
Behind the big stick.
Oh, big stick. Okay. Yeah. All right. So the singularity and the heat capacity as you go through the transition. Here's the flow rate rising sharply as you go through the transition for helium-4. And everything I'm going to talk about today, nearly everything is dealing with helium-4 rather than helium-3. And this is the spectrum of elementary excitations in bulk helium-4. Now, in terms of probing the behavior of bulk helium microscopically, there aren't a lot of probes, basically. There's a lot been done with, the elementary excitation spectrum is derived from neutron scattering. It's a very weak interaction. Impurities have been studied in the form of ions and electrons. And there's not a lot of work really been done. And the main problem of putting probe species into helium is that it's essentially a self-cleaning material. And that's illustrated here with an experiment that Silvera did, putting hydrogen into helium, and this he could observe by eye the aggregation of the hydrogen into long rods, crystallites, which would then either fall to the bottom under gravity, or they would move to the nearest boundary, because everything binds stronger to itself or to the walls than it does to helium. Now, if you think about what people have studied over the years in confined geometries, these are three of the typical systems that people have looked at in terms of doing physics experiments on analyzing, say, the scaling of the superfluid behavior in helium, in films, in aerogels, and in metal matrices under pressure. In all of these systems, you have very strong interaction, again, with the boundaries. In contrast to these systems, the droplets, which are shown, this is experimental apparatus for forming free droplets of helium, they offer a different kind of approach to looking at property of helium and superfluidity in finite size, namely of having a true unconfined, so it's confined by its own surface tension and so on, but it doesn't have any external potential interacting with it in the confinement. And this is a configuration for current generations of helium droplet experiments. And this is primarily due to the pioneering work of a large number of students, graduate and also diplomat students in the Tönnies group over the years 1970s and 80s, who really developed the technology of making these supersonic expansions of helium droplets. And then, in fact, in 1990, by accident, they discovered that they had impurities inside the droplets. Early on, there were some experiments done where people tried to scatter cesium atoms from a droplet when they had pure droplets first formed in the 60s. And they didn't observe any signal on the other side. And they weren't really sure what happened, but there were some conclusions that was there for a signature of superfluidity. when they realized in 1990 that they were having impurities picked up by the clusters, then they went back to those old experiments and they realized that cesium was just getting stuck inside the helium. And it's a very now general phenomenon. Basically, helium's like, it is indeed like cotton wool, as Onnes originally noted. It will absorb virtually anything in a droplet. And there's no, in a droplet, there's no external boundary of stronger binding energy. So the molecule that you put, that you pick up inside, remains in a thermodynamically metastable state, but it remains confined in the interior for the lifetime of whatever your flight time here is, and that's long enough to do some spectroscopy, as was shown by Jacinto Scholes in Princeton. So this is a current type of experiment that's done, where one has a supersonic expansion, and depending on the conditions here in the expansion, I've shown here on the phase diagram, these are isentropic lines here, isentropic expansion lines. So in the early stages of the expansion, you have a isentropic expansion. You can roughly divide, according to these different regimes, the size of droplets that are formed in terms of the initial conditions. So that's used as a crude kind of size control. If you have high stagnation temperature here, that's the temperature behind here, then you tend to get small droplets. And as you lower the stagnation temperature, you get larger and larger droplets. And until finally, actually, you get under certain very special conditions here, you get just monomers again. Yeah, and that's not understood at all. So most of the experiments with molecules inside doing spectroscopy, which I'll talk about today, are really in this regime. So sort of the medium-sized droplet regime, 2,000 helium atoms. And then, okay, so you can have arrange several pickup cells, so you can pick up two different species, say the blue atom in here, or the blue molecule here, and the red molecule here, and you can form complex aggregates inside it, and then you can probe these spectroscopically with a laser, and then detect them either by mass spec or by some kind of bolometric technique. And so with this combination of sort of pickup methods, there's a whole variety, first of all, before you even put extra other sort of complex molecular species inside, you can actually form this fairly nice family of quantum systems by basically mixing helium-3 and helium-4, or adding the additional flexibility of doping with the hydrogen isotopes. And what's shown here is if you put in, for instance, a molecule inside pure helium-3 or pure helium-4, you have two different temperatures. There's small variation in temperature available to you. The helium-4 droplets typically end up, and nobody understands it quite how they end up, but they do end up at temperatures, well-defined temperatures, about 0.4 Kelvin. In other words, the spectroscopy which people do inside the droplets show a Boltzmann distribution, so it seems that there's a well-defined temperature at the end. Helium-3 droplets are somewhat colder. Now, if you do an expansion where you first of all pick up a foreign species and then pick up helium, so you do an expansion with a helium-3 beam, you pick up a foreign species, and then you pick up helium-4, because of the greater binding of the helium-4, the heavier isotope to the molecule with the same potential, you end up having this little shell of helium-4 in a larger helium-3 droplet. So that's a way of forming a helium-4 environment around the molecule with a lower temperature. And then you can do the same kind of tricks with molecular hydrogen. You can form a molecular hydrogen shell. And here there's a helium-3, a helium-4, and a molecular hydrogen shell. So you have a temperature knob there, too.
Excuse me, I'm missing something. The different shells are the same temperature or different temperature?
The belief is that they're all the same temperature. It's
so
equilibrated.
It's
yeah.
Fast.
Yes. Yeah.
How
yeah.
How many atoms are in the helium, the droplet is 2,000.
2,000, and here, well, I'll show you actually some specific example, particularly for this one. But in this case here, you can form, you can add in a controlled fashion anywhere up to a few hundred helium-4 atoms to a droplet of, say, 5,000 helium-3s.
So the time scale of coming to equilibrium is much, much faster than any time scale we're talking about.
Well, this time scale is on the time scale until you get to the detection. That's a few milliseconds, maybe. So it's actually fairly long, okay, in terms of time scale of molecular dynamics. So here's a sort of an overview of the helium droplets now seen from the perspective of someone who wants to maybe study a molecular probe, either from the point of view of understanding the physics of the helium or understanding what the quantum fluid does on a molecular object. So firstly, they are very cold. So we have these two different temperatures that we can work at. One can't, unfortunately, people still don't know how to continuously vary the temperature. So I'll show you in a moment, it's a very gentle quantum matrix for spectroscopy. That's a large factor of the reason why a lot of chemists are now, particularly high-resolution spectroscopists, are interested in these droplets. This is just an example of the kind of high-resolution spectroscopy you can do. This is an amino acid up here, which is probably for this audience a fairly complex molecule, but it's certainly not the most complex molecule that's been put inside these droplets. People have put phthalocyanin, which is a very large aromatic species involved in binding of CO in the blood, in hemoglobin. So you can put these reasonably large biotype systems inside, and you can measure spectroscopy. This is the laser-induced fluorescence, so this is basically from an electronic transition, and what you're seeing here is fine structure associated with vibrational and rotational transitions or modes of this molecule. And this is a blow-up of this spectral region here in the helium-4 droplets, and by comparison, this is a kind of the typical spectrum that one gets if one uses just the more conventional seeded beam spectroscopy approach, which people have used for many years to try to analyze basically the structure and the conformations of these kind of biomolecules. Now, this is not a very extreme case, but this shows that you have a decrease in line width of one order of magnitude. But in many instances, you can get up to two or even three orders of magnitude decrease in the line width. So from the point of view of high-resolution spectroscopy, particularly people in physical chemistry doing biomolecules and larger molecule spectroscopy, these helium droplets really offer a wonderful tool because of the weakness of the interactions. Now, there are some differences, between the spectra you see in the helium droplets and in the seeded beams. For instance, here, so these labels here indicate different conformations or different implicit foldings of this amino acid. And you see, for instance, that this particular conformer A, is not present in the helium droplet. So there's certain differences, and that's due to, of course, the structure of the presence of the helium. But it's just the fact of having this great line width decrease has got a lot of experimentalists very excited in the chemistry community. So there's a lot of activity here to do high-resolution spectroscopy. And right now, I don't know what's the number, but there's probably at least 50 molecules that have been put inside and characterized at this point. And there's also a lot of interest, again, in the chemistry, but also, I think, increasingly in the metal cluster, in the cluster community in physics, to use these droplets as a synthetic tool. Because you can, as I showed, you can have these pickup cells cascaded one after the other. You can form clusters, and now the latest thing is to look for metastable species like diradicals inside these droplets. And there's some very nice work that shows that you can form metal clusters with organic species, and depending which order you do the pickup reactions in, you get different compounds formed. So there's a lot of potential here as a synthetic tool. It's an expensive synthetic tool, but in terms of cluster physics, it's actually quite a useful one. Yeah?
You have the larger molecules on the center, or it depends on what order you try to make
them? The thing that depends on the order is what the structure of the complex that will be formed is. But generally, with a few exceptions, such as alkali metals, atoms which are on the surface, or dimers of alkali metal clusters actually all appear to be on the surface. With exceptions of those species, all other molecules appear to be in the interior of the clusters. Okay. And it's basically just the binding energies. Okay, so let me show you a little bit about... if you're interested, there is a... If I come back to here. There's an article in... a review article in Physics Today last February. By myself and two of the experimentalists, that had sort of an overview of lots of references to all the different variety of kind of spectroscopy that's been done. Now I want to show you just a few of the key results Firstly, the first experiment that indicated that these free droplets are indeed superfluid was this one, which was an electronic excitation of a relatively small molecule shown up here, just two carbon atoms, two hydrogens, and two oxygen, glyoxyl. And what's shown here, I'm sorry for the low quality here, this is Physics Today website, it's not big on high resolution. But this is the electronic excitation spectrum as a function of the excitation frequency. This is a zero phonon line, which is split into three peaks, and they are associated with rotational transitions of the molecule. And then you have this large structure on the side here, which is a phonon wing. And if you do the same experiment in the pure helium-3 droplet, this is a spectrum you observe. There's a shift of the band origin, and this is very easily understood in terms of the different density of helium-4 and helium-3 and the different effects of polarizability. But the main difference in terms of understanding the link to the properties of the fluid is that on the right here, there's no gap, and there's really no observable structure in the phonon wing. Now, Giorgio Benedetti in Milan did a calculation with assuming coupling of these electronic excitations, just assuming you have a sort of expansion of the size of the molecule, which excites compressional modes in the droplet, and then took the density of states to be that of bulk liquid helium and just modified a little bit for finite size. That's the density of states shown underneath here with the roton and maxon maxima there, and finds a very good fit with the theoretical curve is a red line up here going, and it more or less goes exactly through the spectra. So this is taken as evidence that, well, this phonon structure is indeed due to coupling via single phonon and multiphonon excitations to the collective excitation spectrum of helium-4 in the low temperature regime. Whereas the helium-3 droplets, you don't see any kind of gap, and you don't see any kind of structure that can be associated with a superfluid. And of course, helium-3 is not superfluid at temperatures 0.15 Kelvin. So that was the first experiment. The second, another very significant experiment for understanding the role of superfluidity is shown here, somewhat higher resolution. This is a spectrum of a linear molecule, OCS, in helium droplets. And this was sort of, in a sense, a 64,000 Deutschmark experiment. What they did here, well, helium-3, they needed very, very high purity helium-3. And this was obtained from some laboratory in Russia. And so they needed to have this ultra-pure helium-3. They needed less than 1 in 10 to the 6 helium-3 molecules here. And then they performed the spectroscopy of the OCS molecule in a pure helium-4 droplet and in pure helium-3 droplet. You see sharp spectral lines here, which see they've got these numbers on them which denote the transitions associated with a linear molecule. In helium-3, you don't see any kind of structure. You just have one broad band. And then they did an experiment where they took the 3 helium-3 droplets and started to add small numbers of helium-4 atoms in a second pickup cell. So there's additional ones in here. I think the first one was 4, then 20, then 40. You see the structure of this single peak starts to change. At 40, you start to have a sharp peak in the center emerging. At 60, you start to see these side peaks evolve. And at 1,000 helium-4, you basically recovered the spectrum of the pure helium-3, the spectrum of OCS and pure helium-4. Okay, so that fits in with this idea that when you add helium-4 to a molecule inside the helium-3, you're basically adding an inner shell of helium-4. And at size 60 or greater than, you're basically having the reappearance of the spectra observed in the pure helium-4 droplet. Now, the difference between this kind of spectrum in helium-4 and in the gas phase is essentially only that it has different rotational constants than in the gas phase. It has the same linear, it can be fit by the same linear molecule Hamiltonian. And that appears to be a general feature of small molecules, that one has a spectrum which corresponds to a free rotation spectrum, as in the gas phase, but with some modified rotational constants that I'll talk about. Whereas in helium-3, you have this typical broad band, which is the same kind of characteristic behavior as you see in normal, in classical liquids. So this is show, this is a spectrum just schematic for CO. It's another small linear molecule in the gas phase versus in the liquids. And in liquids, there's a very well-developed theory of rotational diffusion, which accounts for this so-called collapse of the rotational structure because of random collisions with the liquid environment. Now, in terms of the two different liquid environments that we have here, helium-4 and helium-3, we can understand, in a perturbative sense, as Babichenko and Kagan showed, one can understand in a perturbative sense why you have this essential, this rotational diffusive behavior in helium-3. It's because the spectrum of excitations in helium-3 has this broad band of particle hole excitations, which have a high density of high spectral density of states and couple efficiently to the rotational levels. Whereas in helium-4, one has these collective excitations which have very weak coupling to the rotational levels. So there's a perturbative analysis here which shows that, yes, indeed, you would expect to have this rotational collapse in helium-3, but not in helium-4. So this is a small...
Can you remind what the Fermi temperature is in helium-3?
Yeah, you're on the degenerate limit, but way away from superfluidity. I can't.
Limit.
I don't know. I can't tell you. I haven't looked too closely at that. Yeah, I don't know. The temperature, yeah, the experimental temperature is 0.15. So yeah, so you're in it's degenerate, but so it's not the same as a normal classical liquid, but we haven't looked too closely at that. Yeah. I mean, actually, all the helium-3 is just understood as being different, and so far, no one's really sort of addressed quantitatively the spectra. Yeah. In contrast, for helium-4, what I'm going to show you is that we have a fairly good, at this point, we have a fairly good quantitative understanding of this dynamics and the spectroscopy and sort of that. So this is just a small sampling of some of the spectroscopy that's been done for small molecules. So these molecules are have all been fit by Hamiltonians with the same symmetry as in the gas phase, and they all share this feature of having a reduced rotational constant relative to the corresponding gas phase value. And these reductions of rotational constant, written here in terms of percent, sort of appear to fall into two groups. There's a group of the heavier molecules, which have in the gas phase already rotational constants of a few tenths of a wave number or less. And these are basically seem to be reduced by a good factor of three or more, whereas much lighter molecules with rotational constants greater than a wave number show only small or even close to zero reduction in the rotational constants. So now I'm going to shift away from overview and talk a little bit about how we understand this theoretically. And everything will now be focused only on the helium-4. And the main reason for that is that for helium-4, we can do we have bosons to deal with, and so we can do a large amount of real numerical calculation without having to worry about the effects of Fermi statistics. So the kind of things that we've done at Berkeley are basically two types of microscopic calculations. One is diffusion Monte Carlo based calculations, which allow one to get the rotational energy level structure directly with or without making nodal approximations. This is a method that can free you up from nodal constraints. Or secondly, path integral calculations, which can directly access, calculate the extent of superfluidity, even in a finite system. So what I'm going to show you now are a little bit of an overview of the direct calculations, and then I'll start to talk about the insight that we have into those direct calculations, firstly from looking at the density analysis and some knowledge we've gained about the extent to which the helium density can move adiabatically with the molecular rotation, and then how this is complemented by path integral studies, and that makes a link to to fluid theory of superfluidity. Okay, so very briefly overview. So diffusion Monte Carlo is a relaxation technique, And so basically, one solves the Schrodinger equation in imaginary time and goes to infinite times, and then one should get the ground state. Now, using methods of important sampling, one can impose nodal structures and also calculate excited states. And the key thing here that makes it relatively easy or straightforward to do is that the trial functions here, if we're dealing with helium-4 droplets, they have boson symmetry, and so they're relatively easy to sample, certainly compared to helium-3. So we've done a lot with this, but then we've also, because in, particularly in this case, the issue of nodal structures is very important, we also go beyond the six-node constraint to look at excited states and evaluate the excited states directly by this method of basically projection, of projector spectral evolution. And this is an approach which is very analogous to the calculation of absorption spectra from a real-time dipole-dipole correlation function, something that's done very frequently in molecular spectroscopy. Well, if you consider an imaginary time correlation function of some operator A, which contains some information, so operator A is basically supposed to take you from the ground state to some region of an excited state of interest, then if you can evaluate this with Monte Carlo, and then one can inverse Laplace transform that, one obtains a spectral function, kappa, which basically consists, in the ideal case, of a set of delta functions at the excitations. So the key here is to find the appropriate projectors which will access the excited states of interest. So in our studies here, we are looking at projectors which basically are closely related to the free molecule projectors of a small molecule. So the rotational excited states of a small molecule. So these are the kind of systems that we've looked at, basically small diatomics, and then this octahedral molecule, SF6. Without going too much more detail, let me just show you typically what one would compute. This is a set of energy levels, just like a spectroscopist would be measuring the transitions between the energy levels. We compute the energy levels by these diffusion Monte Carlo-based techniques, and then we fit this set of transitions to obtain rotational constants, just like the experimentalists do. So it's direct calculation. This was actually a fixed node calculation, but we've done with the analytic continuation, we can access JS3 without too much difficulty, right? And you've done pretty much the same, right? I mean, we have never gone beyond anything with seven nodes in it, okay? And we choose the right symmetries generally so that we would only choose M as zero, so we aren't imposing two nodes in both of the angles. Okay. So we're definitely working with less energy levels in general when we're using the projector method than the experimentalist is. The experimentalists generally don't have a lot of transitions either. This is something that really isn't understood yet. They typically see just as many lines as I showed you in OCS. So you only see up to say JS3 or JS4. And then for reasons that people don't really understand, the spectrum sort of dies away. So this is a summary of results for three of these small molecules. So SF6 is octahedral. That was the fixed node calculations I just showed you. And these are two triatomic linear molecules. And these results here were obtained with this projector method. And here we just calculated one excited state and fit that to the, well, so it's, we calculated one excited state, and we did for NS1, we have the exact spectroscopic results, so we can calibrate things, and then we just go on to larger sizes. So what you see here is as a percentage of the gas phase rotational constant, you see this decrease nicely, and for the two heavy molecules, we get very good agreement with, by the time we reach NS20, which is about one solvation shell, for each, and I'll show you the structure of the solvation shell in a moment. But for each of these molecules, 20 is about the completion of the first solvation shell around the molecule. We see, in both cases of the heavy molecules, we see the rotational constant arrived at is basically identical to the rotational constant measured in a large droplet of 1,000 atoms. Well, that indicates that whatever it is that's renormalizing the rotation is very much a local effect. For the light molecule, we actually don't appear to reach. This is one of the very surprising results, is that the light molecule, one would expect to have something just sort of coming down slowly, and we have an overshoot, And, it's not clear that by a first solvation shell we would even reach the bulk value. And that appears to be a fact that it may be a special effect with the HCN, that there is, in the HCN helium potential, there's a barrier for the for the reorientation of the helium from one side of the molecule to the other. And that barrier lies just about at the point that the zero-point energy lies. So there may be some very unusual quantum scattering kind of resonance that accounts for that, but we don't really know. And that's, okay, so here's a little point about the nodal surfaces. So with SF6, we find that the free molecule nodal surface is, in fact, for NS1, is perfect. It gives exact agreement with exact calculations and with the experiment. For this very light molecule, there's a very interesting feature that if we take this free molecule in the projector calculations, if we take the free rotation projector, which if the molecule is only very weakly perturbed should really put you on those excited states, we get two different excited states. They're both exact, they both correspond to real excitations, but it doesn't seem to be a simple correspondence of this free molecule projector with the actual nodal surface. Whereas in the heavier OCS molecule, we again get only one peak, and there seems to be a close similarity of the free molecule surface, nodal surface, with the nodal surface in helium. Okay, so and the last point I want to make about these direct calculations is that these excitations that we're looking at were chosen to be excitations where most of the angular momentum in the state that you arrive at, the excited state here, basically the angular momentum is located on the molecule. We don't put any relative angular momentum into the helium. No, not in these functions, no. So basically what we have is this kind of restriction allows some kind of renormalization of the molecular motion, but you don't have any real angular momentum in the helium. Okay, so now I'd like to say a little bit about what additional information we can get from looking at the densities. And so when people first started to think about the renormalization of the motion of these molecules in helium, they started to think, well, maybe that's some amount of the helium that's dragged with it. And so initially people were making classical models. What we've done now is to make this more quantitative by looking at seeing just how much the helium density is affected by the molecular motion. And now to put that in context, let me first of all show you what these densities within the first solvation shell look like, and why in fact I'm even talking about solvation shell in helium, because you're probably not used to the idea of having microscopic structure inside a quantum fluid. So this is first of all just to set the scene. This is a comparison of helium densities around these two molecules, linear molecules OCS, a heavier, stronger bound molecule, and HCN, which is a much lighter molecule. These were actually computed by parsonable techniques, but you get pretty much identical results with the diffusion Monte Carlo. So this is the distance away from the molecule. This is the radial distance, right? And this is the distance along the axis. So it's a two-dimensional coordinates. And what you see here is in the heavier bound molecule, you have this very sharp structuring in the angular coordinate. If you have the molecule like this, as you're going around here, there's a very large degree of modulation of the density, and that corresponds to the changes, the modulation of the molecule-helium interaction potential, and the fact that it's very strong. In the HCN case, you have a much weaker binding of helium to the molecule, and so you have a more uniform distribution in this angular degree of freedom. You really have just about this one sort of fence of helium, high helium density there, and then the second solvation shell a little bit further out, but then you have uniform density. Okay? So this first sort of ring, elliptical ring, defines the local solvation structure in helium. And these are the total densities. Now, and this is around the benzene molecule, which is a molecule with six-fold symmetry with an aromatic ring. And what's shown here, I'm not going to explain the coordinates here, but all I want to do to point out here is to show that this calculation didn't include rotation of the molecule. And we can always, in the calculations, we can switch it off. Whereas this calculation included the rotation of the molecule. And the two previous ones I showed you also without molecular rotation. Now, this was a little bit surprising. And a lot of the models that people have developed to explain this molecular rotation were based on densities calculated without rotation, because that's actually a lot easier to compute. What this shows you is that if you incorporate the molecular motion, the molecular rotational motion. So in a sense, you can think of it in terms of a molecule moving in some solvation shell of fluid, quantum fluid, and there's some, because of the interaction with the helium, there's an angular potential. So the molecule, in when you add the rotational degree of freedom of the molecule, there's going to be some zero point of energy due to the angular motion. So you can think of this as this smoothing out here as being an effect of the angular zero point energy of the molecule.
Again, the helium is not rotating.
No, it's ground state. The total cluster is in the ground state. There's no, yeah. So this is for the SF6. So this is just shows you that this for this octahedral molecule, with the example of the octahedral molecule, you can compare the densities along different symmetry axes or along different privileged axes if there's no symmetry. You can compare the densities and come up with a quantifier Q, a quality factor if you like, or a quantifier of the extent to which this adiabatic following holds. With the defining principle being that if the helium were to adiabatically follow the molecular rotation, then the density should be the same whether or not we include the molecular rotation or not. Okay, because our notion of adiabatic following is that the helium will respond no matter what the speed of the molecule is. Okay, and you see that this allows you to really distinguish between these heavy molecules and the light molecules. So the Q factor is large, but it's not one. It's large for the heavier molecules, meaning the helium density can follow with the molecular rotation to a high extent, but it's incomplete, it's not unity. Whereas for the very light molecule, there's essentially zero adiabatic following. So that's very important for developing simple models of the response of helium. And then we can go back to these kind of energy level calculations and rotational constants as a function of n that's shown here now for OCS again. So that was a curve I previously showed. That's a helium droplet value. And what we've added here is this set of points here in blue triangles. These are what you'd expect for rotational constants if you assume that the entire fluid of the droplet were to move with adiabatically with the molecule. So you see that there's a small systematic difference at small sizes, and then at large sizes, this thing just, because it's rigidly including the entire cluster, this just goes down to zero, whereas the true quantum system goes up to this finite value. Now, we've looked at this more carefully here, the transition. And the transition here actually can be very nicely understood in terms of the onset here of permutation exchanges between the helium atoms. If you look at in path integral calculations at these size of clusters, so these are very small numbers of helium atoms, the helium atoms are so strongly bound to the molecule that there's virtually no permutation exchanges between them. Once you start to get to this size, you can have permutation exchanges between heliums located at different locations along the OCS molecule. And then that seems to correlate with this rise here. Oh, I'll come back to that.
I mean, you're at zero temperature.
This is zero temperature.
Always...
Oh, no, okay. The permutation studies are done at finite temperature,
yeah,
0.3 Kelvin.
Temperature
right.
Question, how
right. But we do them all at the temperature correspondence experiment, about 0.3 Kelvin. Right. And then the densities are pretty similar to what they are at zero temperature. We compare.
So that's sort of the classical regime.
These guys are in the classical regime, and so these guys appear to fit with this kind of model, quasi-adiabatic following. That's basically the regime where you talk about a molecular complex. It's really nothing to do with superfluid. Here, by that point here, we think we've got to the regime where we have the onset of superfluidity. It's a very small size system, but we have the onset of these exchanges. Of course, they aren't very long exchanges yet, they only have 20 atoms, but you see that quite clearly. Okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself here. So going back to the blue core of the helium droplet, what is the relation of these energy level calculations? So now I want to make the connection to the two fluid analysis that we developed based on path integrals studies of finite temperature helium densities. And without going into too much detail here, what I'll show you is how we've arrived at a two fluid decomposition of this solvation density around the typical molecule. And the key feature is there that we found that there, because of the molecular interaction with the helium, for the heavier molecules, that there's a certain fraction of the density in the first solvation, which is essentially removed from complete participation with long exchange paths of the helium. So we use that to define a non-superfluid density. And then we can set up a theory for the response of helium to the molecular rotation in terms of the two contributions of this molecule-induced non-superfluid and the residual superfluid, which is characterized by rotational flow. And the elements of this, this little model are that the local non-superfluid, which is localized within the first solvation shell, it goes to zero, essentially outside the first solvation shell. But this adiabatically follows completely, which is essentially equivalent for a localized set of atoms. Essentially is equivalent to rigid coupling. And that gives rise to an increment to the moment of inertia of the molecule. Then if one considers what happens with a superfluid, if the superfluid were to adiabatically follow, there would be a possible hydrodynamic contribution. So your total effective molecular moment of inertia can have, in principle, three contributions: the gas phase value and these two incremental contributions coming from each of the two components of the solvation density. Okay? So now I'll just show you some of the key points of this. This is, so just to remind you that in a path integral approach, one can incorporate the Bose symmetry of the thermal density matrix exactly. And Seppeli and Pollock showed how to compute this with a generalized Metropolis algorithm in the middle 80s, and basically then showed the computation for bulk liquid helium. And the key issue that is in the superfluid regime, you have long permutation paths which connect E atoms to something other than the cells. This would be the path of an atom in imaginary time space if you would have no exchanges. So using this, we defined this local super density decomposition into a superfluid component which comes from long exchanges and a non-superfluid component which comes from small exchanges. And in most of our work, small exchanges have been restricted to less than six atom exchanges or less. Now this is a little bit ad hoc, but you can make it more quantitative by actually taking the linear response estimator and computing the full superfluid tensor for response to rotation, and you get pretty similar results. So what I'm showing you here is for this octahedral molecule SF6 on the left. That's the molecule here in the inside. Around it in this 3D color plot is a plot of this molecular interaction induced non-superfluid density. Blue is low and red is high, and what you see is that the high regions of non-superfluid density are in these octahedral, these triangular sites here of C3 symmetry, which are in the octahedral pockets of this molecule. And so this non-superfluid density kind of tracks the total density because it's basically determined by the molecular interaction. So it's all these densities, and this shown here on the right for the linear molecule OCS, so that was the total density I showed you before. If you look both at the non-superfluid density and the superfluid density, they all have the same kind of shape, same kind of modulations. The difference is in the scale here. The non-superfluid density is much lower in its amplitude than the superfluid density. And it's really only non-zero inside the first solvation shell. Well, you can, the linear response estimator is defined, I can show you afterwards, I have a slide at the back there. It's defined in terms of the area of enclosed by a permutation path squared. Okay, so you average over all the permutation paths in the path integral, or in your particular ensemble, you take the area enclosed by them projected onto a particular axis. So if you're considering the response to rotation around a particular axis, say the molecular axis, you take all the permutation paths, you look at their projected area perpendicular to this axis.
They
don't have to enclose that point, they just have to be perpendicular to that axis. And that gives you the global superfluid fraction for response to rotation around that axis. That's global, right. So if you want to get the local, then you have to figure out a way of dividing up that area into contributions from each of the points along the path. There's no unique way to do that. But you could, for instance, divide up that path into equal contributions, or you could look at where the points on the path are, the beads on the the imaginary time polymer, and you could look at the contribution between two adjacent beads and so on. One of David Seppelin's students has evaluated that by, has looked at that decomposition with equal decomposition of the areas. And gets. No, we use something much simpler. Okay, we haven't done that yet. What we've used is just taking take a density at any one point and look at the contribution to that density that comes from exchange paths shorter than 6 or exchange paths longer than 6. So it's just the length of the path. So our criterion is not identical to the linear response criterion.
Start and finish at that point?
No. Paths that go anywhere. But any path which goes through that point, or that volume, any path that goes through that point that is a less than 6. Okay. Right. Okay. So first of all, if I'm now considering the response of these two different components of locally of the solvation density to the molecular rotation. So first of all, if I consider this non-superfluid, and if you look, there's firstly one interesting thing that if you're considering in mass here, if you look at this light molecule, if you estimate the kinetic energy of the superfluid in very just a simple classical model for rotation around one of the appropriate axes, find that this kinetic energy of the local non-superfluid is greater than the barrier to rotate around that axis. So that tells you there can't be any kind of adiabatic following for the light molecules. So basically, all we can say is really something about the response to rotation for the heavier molecules. So forget about HCN. Now, if we take these two heavy molecules, SF6 and OCS, and we then take this non-superfluid density, which was defined with just the length of the exchange path, so it's not exact. But if we estimate this non-superfluid contribution to the moment of inertia of the molecule, we find, and then use that to extract a rotational constant, we find in both cases, within 10% of the experimental value. And that's very good. Actually, in this case, it's virtually perfect. And here we expect it to be very good because SF6 is a spherical top. It's moments of inertia are identical along all three axes. So the fact that we're not using the proper tensor of the superfluid definition isn't significant here. For OCS, as being a linear molecule, it's basically the limit of a symmetric top. So there's only rotation about the two axes perpendicular to the molecule, and there's no energy for rotation around the molecular axis. So it's very anisotropic in its rotational properties. So therefore, we actually expect this difference is due to the fact that we've used an isotropic approximation in calculating our local non-superfluid density. Okay, got that? So we're not surprised by the 10% reduction there. Now, if we go to the so it appears that the local non-superfluid density is pretty much accounting for all of the added moment of inertia. So what does a superfluid do? Well, if the superfluid is adiabatically following, in addition to the local non-superfluid, then we can basically write a classical hydrodynamic equation for the velocity field of that local superfluid, basically just by taking the equation of continuity and combining it with this boundary condition, which is basically the boundary condition of adiabatic following, which says that the fluid is moving with the molecular motion. So we can obtain a solution for this characterized by the velocity potential, and then we can just integrate over this to obtain essentially kinetic energy of the fluid induced by the molecular rotation, and that can be parameterized in the usual hydrodynamic fashion by an effective moment of inertia increment. So the only thing is we have to solve a 3D partial differential equation. This is what Patrick here has done for SF6. And so this is just a sample of the velocity potential, which is, you see, is very complex. It has radial nodal structure and angular nodal structure for this octahedral molecule. It has a lot of symmetry in it. And this is the current density around in one octant of this frame for the SF6 molecule. And you see that the current is large and very sharp, very varying on a fairly short distance scale in this region of the first solvation shell, and then there are very weak variations in the current beyond that. Okay. Now, if you then extract these increments due to the hydrodynamic response, for SF. Sorry,
so the superfluid rotating now, is that right?
With the molecule. The assumption is it has to rotate. The assumption to solve the equation, we have to assume that it rotates with the molecule completely, so completely adiabatically. And what was shown was the current densities in the lab frame. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's when you have these complex structures.
Okay. Rotating with molecule means that the droplet is rotating rigidly, or just that the vicinity of the embedded molecule is rotating pretty much with the molecule, and in the interior there are things moving in solution.
No, it says that the entire density is rotating unchanged with the molecule. Yeah. Now, the previous work I showed you showed that that's not true, right? It's not complete. But well, this is sort of a devil's argument. What if? Okay.
Okay. It's going to be worse.
Yeah, people have looked. Seppel has calculated the energy of a vortex in a droplet, and it's about 100 Kelvin or so. So that's way above the energies.
And how can it rotate? I thought helium was irrotational.
It is. Oh no. Okay, it is. I mean, but this is the equation of motion here is for irrotational flow, but it's just that the molecule is driving. The density is moving with the molecule, okay, but it still preserves irrotational flow of the helium.
Actually, the density is varying.
So yes.
The rate isn't actually.
Yes.
There's no angular momentum stored in the.
No. You can evaluate the angular momentum from this calculation. There is finite angular momentum. That's why we think it's not right. We don't believe these calculations are working. Because, okay, firstly, let me just show you what you get for the moment of inertia. So we've done these calculations for this octahedral molecule here, and let's see, what do we have here? Okay, so we actually only get a very small contribution to this hydrodynamic moment of inertia. And then the Princeton group has done a lot of calculations using density functional densities, and get significantly higher values. And then there are two things to say about this. One is that if you include rotation of the molecule, so you have this smoothing out of the densities, so that's a calculation shown here, everything drops by an order of magnitude. That's one thing. Second thing is, okay, so this is actually the point that you just brought up, that this solution is associated with angular momentum generation. So if you just make this solution and you evaluate angular momentum, you will get angular momentum, and you can. It's not a lot, but on the scale of the angular momentum associated with a spectroscopic transition, it's large. You can have up to about half an h bar of angular momentum going into the superfluid, and that violates the constraints from the DMC calculations. We feel that this. And then also this issue I'd said before, that there is really only limited angle adiabatic following of the superfluid. And finally this, I showed you the current density plots for SF6. So this current density is changing sign here over a scale of about an angstrom or so. And that's really much on the border of the Helin length of helium-4. So if you're really operating with this hydrodynamic description on the limits of what's acceptable to do with the quantum description of helium-4. So we think there are these three problems with the adiabatic following, and that combined with the fact that we know that there's only limited adiabatic following of the entire density leads us to conclude that in the two fluid analysis where you have these two possible contributions, that we have essentially the partial adiabatic following only, not complete. And basically, we divide it as a non-superfluid density being the part that does follow adiabatically. And the superfluid density is the part that doesn't follow adiabatically. Okay. And also, in terms of the path integral picture, this is consistent with the idea that something which has a long extended exchange path going through the droplet isn't going to be affected by small changes at one point on the exchange path. But that's just a qualitative hand-waving argument. So it appears within the two-fluid analysis that for these heavy molecules, we have a fairly nice quantitative and fairly complete analysis with if we can obtain these non-superfluid densities from macroscopic calculations. Okay. So let me bring up, in terms of the hydrodynamics, a contrasting to, I've just got a few more slides now. So that was all for rotation. And the rotation, we believe that the reason that hydrodynamics doesn't work for the superfluid there is that this is really a very small amplitude, a small length scale that's being probed by the molecular rotation. It's a few angstroms of motion around the in the first solvation shell. If you look at the translational motion of impurity, hydrodynamics appears to work a lot better in the sense, it appears to give much more reasonable results. And if you go back to the very old estimates of the effective mass of helium-3 from Miller, Pines, and Nozier, using variational calculations, they noted already that the effective mass can be to zeroth order, at least, approximated by the mass, the hydrodynamic mass of a displaced sphere. And it's not too bad, actually. If you do this just simple hydrodynamic estimate, you get about 1.67 for the effective mass of helium-3, and the experimental value is about 2.16. Whereas if you do, and this is all estimates based on uniform density, if you do the uniform density estimate of the hydrodynamic moment of inertia coming from rotation of, say, an elliptical molecule, you get negligible results, very little. Now, if you then improve on this and use a quantum solvation density, this is recent work of Lehmann showed that you can basically apply the same treatment as we applied to rotations for translations by taking into account the interaction with the molecule here and assuming this adiabatic following again, and again omitting the non-superfluid density. So for positive ions, one has this snowball-like structure. So if you remove that structure here, which means that for potassium, you remove this first solvation shell and just look at the response of everything beyond there, and then lithium includes everything, with this hydrodynamic description, what you find is that the effective mass is in reasonable, what appears to be a reasonable agreement with the calculation from variation Monte Carlo from the group of Reata. So it seems that it's possible that hydrodynamics may apply to the translational motions, but not to rotational. And that's not too surprising, because the translational motion, and certainly it's been shown by Kochek and other people. I mean, it's a long wavelength motion. It's the limit of a long wavelength fluctuation. So it's not too surprising that that would work maybe quite well with hydrodynamics, with a modulated density. Hydrodynamics for a modulated irrotational density. Whereas for the rotation, you're basically not in a long wavelength limit at all. You have these very small wavelength motions. So this is a conclusion for rotational dynamics, which I think is fairly well understood at this point, namely that one can do these direct calculations, one can get the rotational constants directly, and one can analyze densities and look to what extent the adiabatic following by helium is complete or is non-existent. And that allows one to then go to simple models, such as those developed from the path integral density decomposition, and what that two-fluid model will then appears to say is that the non-superfluid can adiabatically flow, and this non-superfluid appears to account for these rotational, the reduction in rotational constants for the heavy molecules. For the light molecules, we really right now have no recourse. We don't have a simple model. We don't have a simple interpretive model. We have no recourse right now except to do these direct calculations, and they don't offer so much insight. And let me be, in closing, just give you a couple of slides with open questions, things that are completely not understood right now. One of them is the line shapes. This is for OCS. These are pictures of the line shapes for the different rotational lines. This is a 0 to 1, the 1 to 0, the 2 to, 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 1, 3, 3 to 4. And these are the lines going down. This is 1 to 0, 2 to 1, and so on. So these lines on the P and R branches are of opposite symmetry. They're asymmetric in the opposite direction. And they also have differing widths. The widths are the function of J. Essentially, it appears to be linear in the bottom rotational quantum number J double prime, but with a different slope for the P and the R branches. There's currently no understanding of these line shapes at all. And that, you know, that means that we don't understand the dynamic effects or the time-dependent effects of the coupling between the molecule and the helium. And another non-understood point is the centrifugal distortion constants. When you do these fits of a set of spectral lines to extract a rotational Hamiltonian, what I talked about was just extract the first order fit, which is in terms of a rotational constant B. If you incorporate the coupling between rotation and vibration in the molecule, then you have a higher order constants in the fit. And for instance, for a diatomic molecule, if you have a harmonic oscillator coupled to a rotation of a diatomic molecule, you have this centrifugal distortion constant, which tells you how the molecule, a diatomic molecule, how it stretches as it rotates. Okay, so it tells you about the interaction between rotation and vibration. Now, in the fits, in the experiments, done in helium-4, they use, of course, everything they can, because if they have 10 lines, they want to use, you know, three or four spectral constants. And they find something that very surprising, that these centrifugal distortion constants are up to about four orders of magnitude larger than they would be in the gas phase. So that suggests that these, whatever it is, this solvated linear molecule that's rotating, so if you think about the solvated linear molecule as sort of a rigid entity, there must be some very, very loose vibration of the helium against the molecule, which is coupling to the rotation. But that we don't understand right now, quantitatively. But this is a very marked feature of the experiments. And then lastly, just in terms of other topics, that these are topics that we're working on, so the things that we've chosen from the experimental studies that lend themselves quite well to doing microscopic calculations. You can look at these hydrogen-wrapped molecules inside helium-4, and you can analyze the permutation exchanges and the superfluid fractions, and you find that there is indeed an anisotropic superfluidity low temperatures, about 0.15 Kelvin, which is characterized by there being the response to rotation around the molecular axis goes to zero, whereas the response to rotation around the two other axes remains finite. So you have like a solvation-induced molecular superfluidity in hydrogen. And if you accept that you could have this in 20 hydrogen molecules, then you certainly see this in the linear response theory and the path integral calculations for hydrogen. And this gives rise to some anomalies in the spectroscopy that were already discovered in 2000. Some of the spectral lines just disappear in these hydrogen clusters. And that was speculated to be a result of this superfluidity in the solvating hydrogen. So that's one interesting thing. And then there's these mixed hydrogen helium clusters, which have a whole range of phenomena and interesting dynamics interplay between the two quantum systems of different strength. And then lastly, in terms of structures in the response of the helium, which I mentioned in the beginning, in terms of phonon wings for glyoxyl, there's a number of experiments which show unexplained features in these phonon wing structures in helium-4. And there's interesting aspects here about the interplay between the collective modes that I talked about were responsible for the phonon wing in glyoxyl, and additional localized modes of helium that may occur adjacent in the solvation layer around the monomolecule. So this is just some of the future interesting issues. And lastly, I'd just like to acknowledge who've done the work. So this is Patrick Huang, who did all the hydrodynamics. He's right here. You can talk to him if you've got questions about that. And then Patel, who's a physics student, is now at Livermore. Paisani was from Rome, from a group of Giantorco, who's now a postdoc with me. Veal was a postdoc, now back in France. And Saxa, postdoc from Göttingen. And Yongkyung Kwon, who's a longtime collaborator from Seoul, Korea. And thanks for your attention.
Well, I thought the way to define the superfluid density was through, in fact, if you think of the torsional oscillator experiment,
yeah, you know, Gendronic-Esch relay,
which doesn't respond to the rotation.
That's right. So you can calculate that exactly in the path integral, okay?
Well, that's calculations. That's what you should. I mean,
we do. We do that.
The superfluid rotates. I mean, if there are no vortices, which you don't have, then the superfluid doesn't rotate.
Well, we don't think it does rotate, but we had to sort of do these calculations just to see if, because there was a lot of debate about it.
There are other superfluid rotations.
There were others who did believe. Well, look, okay. I don't want to get into the sociology of this, but I mean, okay, so there are these sets of calculations here, okay, done by others who did believe. And so, you know, they find a big effect here. And so often people do calculations and it's a big effect and close to experiment, and so they get very excited and so on, but without worrying about the basic assumptions.
These droplets are large enough, I suppose, that the super order parameter varies as a function of distance in the center. You might think that, you know, it depends which direction is where the interface between this stuff and the outside is.
The size of them is about 10 or 15 angstrom in radius. And the order parameter, does it really vary over that range?
No,
I thought it's four. It's one angstrom, right. But the order parameter is defined, helium lengths are very small.
Yeah, that's why you would have been thinking about bulk physics.
Right.
So is it big enough, you don't, I mean, whatever variation would be within one molecular atomic size of the outside. And when these are produced in experiments, are they seen ever to be spinning or anything, the droplets? Can you see it? Is there any way of telling they are?
Not of seeing it. I mean, they're thinking that they would love to be able to do that, but there's no way that anyone's. I mean, the most direct probe that people have found is to put something inside it, right, and then to probe the molecule. I mean, they must have, okay, when you actually shine light on the molecule, so that you, if you put 2,000 wave numbers in there, then actually the energy is going to go to the helium and you're going to blow a lot of stuff off the surface, and then probably you're going to impart a lot of angular momentum, but there's no way right now of measuring that. So basically the way they measure the signal is by looking at the depletion in the mass spec of a particular cluster size. And the depletion is because things have evaporated, and so the cross-section for absorption has changed, and then therefore it looks like a depletion. So it's a very indirect dynamical measurement. But there's no way of, if they were to be able to pick to measure the stuff that comes off, the evaporated helium as well, and to do kind of coincidence measurements, but that's too hard right now. So, and they've tried to, so I went back to the beginning, they have tried to make these expansions go closer and closer to the lambda transition, because you're supposed to, if you expand through the lambda transition, you're supposed to actually be able to form clusters with lots and lots of vortices. But so far what they see is when they get closer and closer to the lambda transition, the clusters get larger and larger as you go to lower temperature conditions, but then at one point you just get monomers again. So they haven't really been some people are actively looking for that, but they haven't. There's no way they have so far managed to detect whether the cluster is formed in a high angular momentum state.
If you want to do spectroscopy just with these same molecules in bulk, similar
to helium-4? So far, people haven't managed to do it, because if you put them in bulk, they just go to the walls. Yeah. So that's the beauty of this free droplet. Yeah. There is a group working on it. What you can do now with spectroscopy in bulk helium is you can do alkali metal atoms. You have some piece of metal and you ablate it, and you just look at the cloud of alkali metal atoms. So far, that hasn't been successful so far with molecules.